From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show on a mission to ignite the entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. We do that by building the backyard advantage. And today on the show, we have Jay Ezell. He is the managing director, founder of Natoma Wealth. And he is part of this backyard advantage, right? This love of Sacramento entrepreneurs and giving them the advantage that they need, that you need, that I need in order to achieve our goals and really to change the world. So he's going to be sharing some strategy today about when you win, what do you do? And maybe there's a plan that you should be making before you win, before you create the big business. Because, you know, in life, if we don't make a plan and work the plan, many times we don't do as well as we could have, and we don't want to pay too much money to the IRS or to other agencies. We'd like to save some of that money so that we can redeploy it and create some real wealth and some real opportunity for ourselves and for others. So stick around, enjoy the story, the very important information that Jay Ezell has to offer. Stick around.
Entrepreneurs are the heroes of the American economy. They take the risks, create the opportunities, and move the molecules. Now, back to the Marquee Media Studio, it's the Mark Haney Show.
What if we did it? What if we actually did it? We built a company that had a lot of value. We had great sales. We were starting to get noticed in our industry. And then, unexpectedly, unsolicited, we get an offer. Somebody wants to buy us. Are we ready? Am I ready? Am I prepared? Am I prepared to maximize the opportunity? Today, I'm here with Jay Ezell. We are going to be talking about some of those questions today. And Jay is an expert in this realm and helping people to basically understand and plan how they might go about that process and what they might do in that next phase of their life. He's the managing director and founder of Natoma Wealth. He's a good buddy of mine. So we're just going to like kind of peel back this mystery, because there's a lot of people, I hear this all the time, there's people that are starting to think about, hey, my company's starting to do well. Oh, I wonder, is it valuable? And so thoughts, maybe you guess your overarching, first of all, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks,
and,
appreciate it.
Any overarching thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's a common thing that we hear from a lot of people. You know, people spend so many years building up something that's they're passionate about, they care about. And more times than not, it kind of comes out of the blue. And what we hear from most people is like, holy cow, this is exciting, but am I ready? What happens next if I do decide to kind of take an exit at this point? So yeah. It lends itself to a lot of really good discussions, I think, at the end of the day.
All right, well, let's go through this. And maybe we'll talk about sort of the pros and cons about being ready to begin with. And then you gave me a list of questions that I think really lend themselves to kind of putting that hat on. So I'll put on the hat of the person that's built the company. Sure. And I'm trying to decide how ready I am, and we'll let you answer the question. So this is gonna be a little bit different than what we normally do, but then yeah. At the end I also have a ChatGPT set of questions that one of my teammates came up with.
Got it.
And we'll see how much overlap that is there is within ChatGPT.
Sure.
and the list of questions you gave me.
Got it. Yeah.
And just compare and contrast. Okay, yeah. So what if we actually did it? Okay, so thinking about the pros and cons about being ready, mm-hmm. One of the things that you mentioned is, what is the value of my business and what's the best way to position it for sale?
Yeah. So I think that's one of the exercises that most owners aren't necessarily going through every day. Not thinking about, from our perspective, what we hear a lot is it's more of a lifestyle entity, right? It creates an income stream that they can live, support their family, do all these things. and then give back the passion that they have for the business to the community that they serve. But it's very rare to find an owner that at some point is saying, hey, I'm going to stop and pause for a second and say, what's the equity value of the business? And that's super meaningful as people either think through the idea of exit. I'm aging out. I've been running for 25 years. And you know, my wife is telling me I got to slow down a little bit. You know, how do I think about what it's actually worth? Or to your point earlier, if there's an unsolicited knock on the door and somebody says, hey, we've heard and seen lots of great things. We want to talk about maybe an acquisition. And so going through that exercise of, you know, a formal process of saying, here's all the assets of the business, here's the enterprise value, the goodwill, all those things, very, very meaningful process to go through just to give yourself as an owner the idea of, okay, here's what it might be worth. What are the next steps to go through an exercise of saying, okay, do I sell internally? Is there an interest in that? Is it better to look outside? And then what sort of strategic partner makes the most sense internally within the organization, with management or employees, or looking at strategic buyers on the outside?
You know, I keep thinking of that TV movie, Jerry Maguire, where his client says, show me the money, right? Show me the money, Jerry.
Right.
And Jerry says to him, it's not really all about the money now, is it?
Right.
And Cuba Gooding Jr. kind of pauses. It's not all about the money, is it? Right. So, and I think when you think about the reasons why people want to sell, how important is the money?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it always varies, you know, on a relative, you know, importance as we go through the process with different individuals. But I think what I would say, money is always important because, again, it gets you from point A to point B. If I'm now I've built up this enterprise that has meaning and value to its customer base, to its employees, and as an owner, and now I might want to exit. What we found more than not is the engagement of thinking about value also brings back the importance of how valuable the employees are. That came up literally in a discussion with a client that's going through a transaction right now, how much he truly values the employee base to the point to where they start talking about phantom stock or other things that key people in the organization can participate in the transaction, which I found really meaningful because no one builds a business by themselves at the end of the day. And if you can really step back and say, what do I need as an individual, as a founder, to be able to move on to the next phase of my life? How can I reward those that helped me get there? I think that's super important.
Yeah. What we see a lot in the startup community is stock options. So when you start the company or when you get a round of financing, the people investing want you to have stock options so that we take care of the employees and so that they're motivated to continue to build the company,
right,
and push it all the way through the exit.
Sure. Yeah.
So, but if you're up against the timing and you haven't done some of that, how soon, when's it too late? I mean, you think about timing, you get an offer, and is it too late then to begin the plan?
A lot of times, if you're thinking about those kinds of strategies, if somebody's knocked on the door, you know, at that point, you're really just talking about, you know, quality of earnings studies, you're going through those kinds of exercises. There's not a lot of time to think through, okay, now I should step back and how do I reward key people or the overall population? Again, that's why the folks that we're engaged with and doing work with, even if they're not even looking at transactions, just going through the idea of eventually you're going to exit, because you can leave a business one way or actually two ways. One, you plan for it. Again, if somebody knocks on the door or you're planning ahead, or unfortunately we've seen it where founders pass away. And if you don't plan effectively with either strategy on a proactive basis, you're not going to exit the way that you want at the end of the day. And the people that you want to reward or take care of don't really get that benefit. So that proactive thought and planning, whether it's year one or year 30, depending upon the life cycle of the business, is very, very important.
All right. Question number two. Is my business transferable and attractive to multiple buyers?
Sure. Yeah, that's a really... really important question to ask, because as we found with most founders are the guy that or the people that wear the most number of hats. They're the upfront salesperson on the front end, they're running the business, they might be the CFO behind the door. And the trouble is, if you've got somebody, whether it's inside or outside the organization, that's going to take over and fill your shoes, can they? Meaning if you're the person with all the key customer contacts, well, the relationship sits with you. And if you're no longer there, it's not necessarily the same transferable business as they're looking to acquire. So that's, again, part of the exercise is saying, how can you, through efficient, strategic thought and planning, start to work yourself out of a job at the end of the day? That's really what you have to do, to step back to where those people that can remain still run the business, and the business continues to grow without you serving in all those roles.
So your company is more valuable when you work yourself out of a job.
Well, yeah, potentially, yeah. Because it's the longevity of the business remains. It's much more transferable. And when you've got a strategic acquirer coming in, somebody outside, so if I own a manufacturing company that makes a widget and there's a larger one from the East Coast that wants my geography, they don't necessarily want me to stay there. They want the customer base. They want all of those connections and things like that. So it makes it more attractive. And that's important when you start to think about valuation and multiples and things like that.
Okay, so now I'm going to put the question number three out there. And this is one that I think a lot of people would be thinking about. Am I prepared to step away?
Right, yeah. So think about a founder, 30 years ago that started a business. Most entrepreneurs that we know are grinders. They just work and work and work to the point even where there might be some sacrifices along the way. And if now you're thinking of, well, what do I do tomorrow after I exit? Do I get up and have a cup of coffee? Am I thinking about starting up something else? Going through that qualitative exercise of saying, what's important to me? What's part of my value system that now that I might have more free time, what am I going to do to remain engaged and healthy and a positive member of the community that I serve? That's something that I think is missed a lot of times. As we think about transactions, it's usually the quantitative piece. What's it worth? What's the multiple? How do I exit? What's an earnout? All those different factors. But if I'm not ready to actually be gone from the business, then there's this big gap. And when we see that gap that's not addressed early enough, you can have a very unsuccessful exit as a founder to where they tend to maybe flounder a little bit or trying to figure out what's life look like for them after exit.
I think I'm an example of that to a certain extent. We sold a company that I was the CEO of, the president. Moving forward, I was going to run the company, and that wasn't in the cards. And I ended up leaving unexpectedly. I did not get fired, okay? but I left because it became very corporate, and I wasn't able to fulfill my dreams within the company. So I left, but I hadn't thought it through at all.
Yeah.
And so I was lost. Right. I was stuck.
Yeah.
And it was better than being in the jail sentence that I was, but I sure wish I would have thought it through a little bit in advance.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree with that. And that's something that, going through an exercise of what does life look like for me today as I'm working in the business and kind of thinking about an exit at some point down the road. What are the meaningful parts of my life away from work? And can those remain? Is that community or collective group that I call friends and family around the business, does that remain when I exit? And if it doesn't, you've got to think through the exercise of, does it make sense to start expanding that?
Okay, question four. Are there gifting strategies that I should consider?
Sure, yeah. So as we go down the process of saying, at some point there's going to be an exit, whether it's, again, even if it's unexpected, a knock on the door, there's still time if there's no term sheet or things like that that are signed that you can say, well, if I've got, we were talking about kids, if I've got kids in the family that I can think about shares of my company to gift down using discount valuation or different things like that, how can I use strategies to either positively impact the tax exposure that I might take? Obviously, there's different tax ramifications with the state that you reside in. But thinking through those exercises with good legal and tax advisory makes a ton of sense. In addition, as much as making sure the business is, highly operationally efficient, all the things that a strategic acquirer might want to look at, thinking through that from a personal standpoint can provide a lot of value.
So thinking about the wealth transfer effect, so that if you gift it after the fact or in your estate potentially, when you die, it would be paying more taxes.
Yeah, so we've had lots of clients go through the exercise of saying, we're going to take a certain number of shares, percentage of ownership, and gift that down generationally. And there's lots of advanced trust planning that you can do to execute on that. And that can fund entities or accounts to then support education, opportunities for entrepreneurialism in their own family. That's transferred at a very efficient perspective. So,
okay, so when I do that, let's say I create one of these trusts and sure. that gifts it in advance, they still have to pay tax on the value of the company when you give them those shares.
Yeah,
right?
Most times you'll see legal and tax advise the use of whether it's limited marketability discounts, lack of control, because you're splitting up, say if it's 100 shares, you're splitting up fractionally. And so now a 20% interest in a business is much less attractive than 100% of a business. And because of that, there's different discount valuations okay. that can be used.
So, okay, yeah. Cool. And then if you do it virtually simultaneously, then there's enough money for tax as well sure. if there is some tax consequence.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yep. Okay, question number five. Do I have a cohesive advisory team in place?
Yeah, so that's one.
No. I'll yeah. answer that one for you.
Yeah,
there you go.
Yeah, it is surprising when we've you know been brought in an engagement and start talking to folks, and they'll have seven attorneys between patents and all these different things lined up, and then we ask the question, okay, so who's advising you on your estate? Who's advising you on tax? These different parties of what we would call a cohesive team. And we'd ask the question, and it's, well, I'm not quite sure. Or are these folks, are they working and are they playing nicely together for the benefit of you? And there's quite often that's not the case. Because certain experts in certain areas, you know, a patent attorney is not necessarily the attorney you want talking through transaction strategy. You know, you want a business transaction specialist or talking through estate planning, because those are very granular strategies you have to think about. And then tying that together with tax and overall advisory, it's very, very important. Because if you have that, at least in our experience, if you have that kind of cohesive, really highly operational team, it can really lend itself to a really efficient exit.
Yeah, because remembering back to, you know, sold a few companies and sure. it's always a stressful time. And typically your head's down in the business because you want to make sure you're hitting your numbers going up, yep. you know, all the way to the exit. And in terms of leading a cohesive team
right.
That's not focused on, you know, running the operations of the business, you don't have time to do that when you're the founder or the entrepreneur in most cases. So thinking about that, is that where you guys step in? You run the team?
Yeah, most times. And so I wouldn't say we necessarily run the team. Our job is to make sure that everyone is present. Making sure that the folks that are sitting at the table are, one, focused on the best interests of the client, and two, that they're knowledgeable in the areas that, in our experience, they need to be. And if not, that we're going to try and find the folks that can fill those gaps. And then just making sure that we've got an operational schedule that is in line with a potential transaction timeline, thinking through what the overall goal of the client is going to be. Again, it's not always about just the money. How do we operationally build a structure and design that's going to make the most efficient exit? And then just quarterback it and make sure that we've got everybody running on all cylinders saying, hey, if this is due at this time, we've got to make sure it's done.
So these are, okay, let me go through what the advisory team might look like. In sure. Let's say you sell your company and you got a great exit. You can afford to hire the right professionals. Mm-hmm. Who do I need on my team?
Yeah, yeah. So you'll definitely want a tax. That we'll just start there in okay, a general concept.
Tax. Is that a tax attorney, or do I need my somebody obviously who understands tax ramifications associated with a big exit?
Correct. Okay. Yeah. That's, so it's typically
so a
CPA.
Top accountant?
Yeah. Okay. Typically a strong CPA with a good expertise or experience with entrepreneurs and exits. One, two. We'd always recommend estate planning attorneys. Very important as we talk through either pre-transaction, again, gifting strategies, things like that, and then post. How do we start to set it up?
Yeah, estate planning, they're tax specialists as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not all are, okay. but many of them are. And there's a lot of great firms in town, Northern California, that can support that ecosystem. So.
Okay. And so that's an attorney as well.
Correct.
Okay. So you got a top accountant, top attorney associated with the state.
Right.
Okay.
Selfishly, firms like ours, I mean, yeah. our job again is to quarterback, but look at the big picture, looking at not just how do you allocate assets post exit, but making sure pre and during everything is coordinated and organized properly. And then most importantly, when you think about post-exit, what do I do with my capital now? What do I do with my balance sheet? How does that expand? And be allocated the proper way to serve my family, looking at everything, not just public markets, not just private markets, but how they all blend together to make sure that they meet all of our goals.
You know, my wife would say we probably need a travel planner too.
Sure.
Somebody to sort of plan out.
Totally agree with that. There's all those little ancillary pieces you can fill on the team for sure.
That's awesome. Okay, so that kind of covers section one, our first five questions. Sure. Pre-planning thoughts on an exit. And again, we're going to compare how this goes against ChatGPT,
sure,
so that we'll see if the AI people or AI robots or whatever they are thinking the same way as you.
Right.
Okay. So balance sheet allocation thoughts. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let me put that hat on real quick here. Yep. So what are my cash flow needs and what are my aspirational goals?
Sure. So there's two parts. And I think that's, we talk a lot about qualitative and quantitative discussions. And as a math nerd, you know, those are important as we think through the idea of, you know, if I've got X amount of capital now and I know that I have to live, right? I've got to have, even if I don't owe anybody anything, which is always a good goal to have, but you've got obligations you've got to meet, lifestyle, travel, property taxes, whatever it might be. So we've got to think through not just the cash flow planning of how do we generate an efficient rate of return from income to support my lifestyle moving forward, but also aspirational goals. And why that's important is as we think through all the pieces of planning, there might be something, if I'm charitably inclined, as I know you are, thinking through the exercise and idea of, well, how do I now execute on that value system that I have now with a different capital position? How do I most efficiently execute on that? And so there might be pre-transaction planning that occurs where maybe there's a family foundation that's set up and that can then execute through my aspirational goals of giving back to my community, supporting an ecosystem that's important to me. That's all part of, you know, the overall exercise of going through, you know, the exit process and then thinking through what does life look like for me.
Yeah, I didn't think about that a lot, thinking back to this transaction that we had several years ago. But we did end up starting, after the fact, a nonprofit, 501c3,
sure,
and we've dumped a lot. We've invested a lot of money into helping veterans. But we also started a couple of donor advised funds.
Sure.
And these are, you know, you're expensing. These are good tax. If you want to give that way charitably. And you
absolutely
can find tax benefits for that.
Yeah, there's really efficient mechanisms when it comes to charitable giving. So foundations are a little more complicated. There's a lot more legal structure and design around those. Donor advised funds are fantastic. They're very efficient. You can control how they're invested, how they're allocated, when you give. Even if you give a lot of capital in one calendar year, it doesn't all have to be distributed in the same calendar year. So there's a lot of things that folks can use as they go through this process of wealth creation, taking maybe an illiquid asset, again, whether it's an entity in business, piece of large real estate, whatever it might be, and creating that design that helps them accomplish their goals.
Well, think about cash flow too. I mean, I know it's a math problem, but I talk to entrepreneurs. I have a lot of friends that have sold their companies and invariably, you know, they were, let's say they had a $100 million a year company. Mm-hmm. They're taking millions out of the business every
sure
year. That's a nice paycheck.
Right.
You get used to living on that lifestyle. And then now you have this chunk of money sitting in investments or a bank account. And you're worried about running out of money, right?
Yeah.
It's the craziest thing.
Right.
These super wealthy people are still worried about running out of money I'm not getting my paycheck every month or every quarter.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. It's an odd thing to hear, but we hear that so often. Are you sure I'm not going to run out of money?
Yeah.
And there's never ever a guarantee to that. The exercise that should be engaged in is, again, thinking about the quantitative piece, how much do I really need? And then plugging in some aspirational things. Hey, we're going to take this big trip every other year. It's going to cost me $100,000, whatever it is. Plugging all in. And then it is just math, really, at the end of the day. And then building out an allocation model that says I can get X amount of income, so money to live on, with as the most efficient exposure to tax. So going through those exercises. But that is a comment that I hear more than I think you'd expect to hear.
Yeah, I mean, it can even create marital problems, right?
For sure.
Because one of the partners might view things through a different lens.
It's totally. Yeah, where are we going to get paid again? What's going on?
Exactly.
Yeah, totally agree with that.
Okay, so question number two. How do I optimize my balance sheet to create diversification and efficient total return to support my lifestyle and goals?
Yep. So as you go through the exercise of thinking, okay, now I've hypothetically gone through an exit. I've got this, what I will call, I use buckets. I use these terms a lot. Silos or buckets. I've got this bucket of capital now. What do I do to make sure that I'm ensuring that I have a paycheck that's going to show up in my account so my wife doesn't get mad or my spouse doesn't get upset? And how do I do it in such a way that, one, spreads risk? That's one of the most important things we talk about. Concentration is not necessarily a bad thing. Most wealth creation comes from concentration of some sort, either in a business entity that you founded, scaled, and exited from, stock options or okay. public market securities.
Yeah, you've got a lot of your chips in one basket when you build a big company like
correct.
That. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the goal, now that you've, you know, reduced that risk by not having concentration, is spreading risk across lots of different asset classes, some of which have better tax efficiency than others. But the goal of any plan should be, how do I take capital and spread it across the various pieces, public, private, and there's lots of subsets of that, public market securities, you know, equities, fixed income, cash, private, hedge, venture, direct real estate, lots of different things. And then how do I create, one, a cash flow stream, and then two, just an overall growth pattern from that portfolio, expected return of that portfolio that meets my goals.
So from the cash flow, that's an interesting question, is because cash flow, if you need you know, a lot of money to live on,
yep.
then you need to have a decent amount producing cash.
Correct.
What kinds of things are more cash producers? I'm thinking of real estate because, you know, Procter & Gamble stock's not throwing off that big a dividend.
Right. No, right? You're totally right. And that's the big part of the exercise, to go through and say, okay, if I need a much higher income rate than my growth piece needs to be, because I need cash flow to support lifestyle, then you would think about something like direct real estate. You'd think about direct lending platforms, which in the public markets you can find. You can find in venture and hedge as well, you know, middle market lending organizations and things like that, to really push that yield up higher. We're finally in an environment where we can actually earn a little bit of money in the public fixed income markets. It's been a very long time, mm-hmm. you know, 18 years or so, to where you're actually buying at reasonable prices and getting reasonable yields. But again, blending all those out. And so if we've got someone that is more income focused than total return focused, we'll lean on areas like that. Real estate has a lot of subsectors. So if you think about real estate, you know, whether it's public market securities or direct real estate, you have to think through the exercise of what's the risk pattern of, as an example, in this market, office space versus self-storage versus mobile home, mm-hmm. as just three examples of subsets of real estate. What are the efficiencies of income? What's the opportunity set from an economic perspective? Again, those are all risk-based questions that we would go through the exercise and solve for.
Yeah, it's interesting because you mentioned mobile homes, probably one that most people wouldn't think of off the top of their head, but there's actually tax benefits mm-hmm. in investing, you know, accelerated depreciation when you invest into a mobile home or mobile home park. And
yep.
that can feel really good.
Absolutely. And it really can serve, again, depending upon the amount of passive income one might earn from other things, it can help offset a lot of different things. And again, that's where, going back to cohesive team, making sure that you have folks on the team that surrounds you that can, if I'm an advisor saying, I think we should allocate this way, sitting next to me should be the tax advisor saying, yes, that makes sense, and here's why, because that's their area of expertise. And so making sure that we have those ongoing recurring discussions are very, very important.
And opportunity zones is something that you didn't mention. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of a specific thing that ends up coming up if you have an exit like that, because you can defer some tax.
Yep.
And can you give just a quick explanation as to how those work?
Yeah. So that was part of the most recent tax code change that came through. And an opportunity zone is, there's certain zip codes throughout the United States that were deemed areas for infrastructure development. So thinking about, how do we bring these communities up? And so an opportunity zone investment allows for the deferral of some sort of gain, capital gain typically, up until 2026. And then there was a piece where you had a step down in basis to where it actually reduced the overall gain piece. But again, going back, it defers the gain, doesn't eliminate the gain in the transaction, but defers it. And then you take capital from the transaction and invest in an opportunity zone. If you hold it for certain periods of time, any growth of that new investment is tax exempt.
Right. So yeah, the thing doubles in value in 10 years and you still got the thing. That profit, that gain, is not taxable.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So there's lots of things.
If on an exit, if you sell the asset.
Right. And the thought process behind an opportunity zone is twofold. One, I get the benefit of deferral, so I don't have to pay the check today on the transaction, and I can potentially have tax-exempt growth on a new investment, which is great. Opportunity zones are typically buildups, so like the income schedule takes a little longer to start to accrue. So if we're thinking about current cash flow, we've got to, how do we take that piece we're not earning from today? Where are we going to get the income to offset that from other pieces of the portfolio?
Okay.
So,
cool.
Yep.
That brings me, I wanted to touch bases with you. Okay, so let's say I had an exit today.
Sure.
And I've got a chunk of cash. I want to talk about the economy a little bit.
Sure.
So in today's environment, we're worried about inflation. There's high interest rates, which you touched on. There is geopolitical risk. We got stuff going on with China. You know, the devaluation of the dollar. All this stuff is kind of like chatter in our mind. We even have technology like AI, which we mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. How are these things going to all coalesce? And what's the economy going to look like a year from now? Is there going to be a better buying opportunity, investing opportunity in 12 months? Sit on my 4.5%, 5% cash?
Mm-hmm. Thoughts? Yeah, it's a great question. Yes. it's probably a loaded question, so I'll be a little careful how I answer that. A lot of it depends on, again, the individual situation of somebody, what silo or sleeve of the investment portfolio they would look to. The benefit of having the ability to look at different pieces of the investment universe is that, again, depending upon capital position, I can look at a longer-term allocation to something like hedge or venture that, say, the economic environment today is challenging, which I would think that it is, you've got a longer runway. So you can deal with volatility, deal with economic cycles, because, again, the goal of this is, early stage, scale, exit, 5, 7, 10 years down the road. When you think about public markets, which are much more liquid, much more available to see what values are, right or wrong, 2022 was probably a year that most people didn't want to see the values of public market securities. It's all about how you blend it. So when you think about the environment we're in today, there's always headwinds. This is my 24th year of doing this work for other people. And there's always headwinds. I think back to the dot-com bubble burst in March of 2000, September 11th, obviously 06 to 2011. There's always challenging things. There's always mistakes or missteps we might see out of Washington, D.C., and then the geopolitical environment. And so where we sit today, from our perspective, there are really good opportunities to invest. If you're thinking long-term capital allocation, for shorter term, we're much more cautious. So we're thinking through the idea of preservation for certain pieces of the balance sheet. But we're always going to step back as a planning-based firm and say, what are we trying to accomplish? Mm-hmm. How many, for each unit of return that we're trying to get, how many units of risk do we actually have to take? And so we might shore up risk in environments like this with pieces of the portfolio design, again, public or private, because we don't see as an attractive environment in the next 6 or 12 months. But again, making sure it all ties back to the end goal of a client is the most important thing that we have to think about.
Yeah, I just keep thinking about stuff that I've heard that Warren Buffett has said about how he made most of his money with a very small handful of investments that he bought at the right time.
Yeah.
And so timing can be really important in deciding how much you're going to bet.
I totally agree. He has the benefit of a very large capital position. So I remember back in the financial crisis when he came in and bought some very attractive securities of publicly traded banks, got preferred returns that most of us couldn't get. If you can be smart about how you're thinking about allocation, it clearly fit in his plan and design for his company. And not that you have to be Warren Buffett. If you can think through the exercise of where can I take risk? Where's the opportunity, whether it's short or long term, to maximize gain for the units of risk that I can take? There's lots of things out there that, in our opinion, look very appealing and attractive even in today's environment.
Very cool. Okay, next question. Question number three here in the balance sheet allocation thoughts. What is my comfort level with the various investment sleeves? Do I prefer liquidity via public markets, or does my plan allow for longer term strategies like real estate, private equity, venture, hedge? You touched on that a little bit.
Yeah. And that's really a function of comfort level, what I would say, on information. So when you think through the idea of if I own the S&P 500 index, right? It's very easy for anyone that has a computer whether or not they're in the industry of investing, to see one, what the constituents are, two, the weighting inside of that index, and then three, what the underlying performance of those companies are. It's very, very simple, very straightforward. As you go through expanding that universe and saying, okay, now I'm getting away from the public markets, and there has to be a reason to do that. You shouldn't just say, well, I'm going to go, you know, invest in this hedge fund if there's not a rational reason as to why. But going through the exercise and saying, okay, now I'm going to invest in something that the time horizon of return, S&P, I'm thinking, you still should be thinking a market cycle. So 3 years, 5 years, something like that. Even though it's liquid, you can get in and out on a reasonable basis. If I start to expand into something that the time horizon for return is now minimum 5 years, more than likely 7 years, 10 years, 12 years. One, from a liquidity perspective, can I manage to that? Does my balance sheet allow for that? And then two, am I comfortable with the idea of hiring LP firms like the Growth Factory, other ones that I'm going to delegate responsibility for the decision-making and choice of the underlying portfolio holdings? If I can deal with those things, then you can go through the exercise of exposing the portfolio to those kinds of allocations. But I would say that's something that's very important to think through. How much of each of those sleeves or silos you invest in, again, should be driven by the underlying goals, because we have clients that might be, you know, 30% public markets, 70% direct investment through private equity, hedge, and venture, because it fits their goal profile. We have some clients that are 50% public markets. So it's all a function of what am I trying to accomplish, and then what is in the universe that I can really look to explore and invest in.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about age too, how old we are and how that might affect, because realistically, if you're a little bit older, you might want to take a little bit less risk,
right?
And it might be more preservation and, you know, thinking about handing this off to your kids, or maybe cash flow and living a lifestyle.
Right.
But if you're younger, you can take a little more risk. And so you think about things like venture capital, it's more risky. There might be a more, higher risk reward profile,
sure,
than maybe real estate.
Right.
But so real estate might be much better for somebody.
Right. Yeah. It's all, again, going back to the exercise. We have some clients that have exited businesses in their, say, mid-40s, that because the exit was very, very strong, and their lifestyle needs are very minimal, is not the right term, but I'm going to use that on a relative basis for creating cash flow. They can be incredibly conservative in portfolio allocation because they know that they'll never spend. They're not buying jets. They're not doing all this, you know, really, really lavish things. They can be really conservative and be thoughtful about, okay, well, I know I'm never going to spend it down, or it's very rare for me to be able to do that. So now I can be conservative in my allocation, be thoughtful about it, start bringing my kids in and educating them on being good stewards, and then thinking through how do I either transfer or how do I start to give to support. That allocation is going to look entirely different than someone that says, well, you know, I'm okay with liquidity and cash flow, but I'm okay with risk too. And so let's look out into the marketplace, direct investments in private companies, venture, hedge, real estate, those kinds of things.
How often do you see people that, like, I sold my companies when I was 47, I think. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've had a few exits smaller since then, but I felt like I was still young, right? My brother retired, he's golfing, and he took a very conservative approach. I'll go make it again. I'll do it again,
exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And there's a certain desire to want to use your some of your proceeds to go recreate something special.
Yeah.
How do you advise people to kind of think that through?
Yeah, so I will say,
you may have stopped me.
Well, I don't know. I would say the latter of those two examples is the more common theme for the entrepreneurs that we work with.
Okay.
You know, it's very rare. I had lunch with some folks that sold a company recently, and it's very rare to see an entrepreneur that just sits on their hands or says, hey, I'm just going to go travel or play golf every day. Entrepreneurs are a funny breed, and I mean that in a very good way, in that they have insights and passions that they really want to execute on. And if they've got a community around and then have a capital position where either they can self-fund or bring a group together and fund another project, it's very rare to see them to say, nah, I'm just not going to do that.
You know? Well, I'm living proof that it's not easy to recreate. You know, once you're starting from scratch again,
right,
it is hard. I forgot how hard it was, but thankfully I've got a damn good team. So
yeah, there you
it's
go.
Helped out.
Yeah.
And some great business partners. So,
yeah.
So thinking, last question here, I think question number four, roles and responsibilities of the financial advisor versus the wealth advisor.
Okay.
I didn't even know there was a difference.
Yeah. What I would say is really perspective. And so the way that we view the difference is one, experience and expertise. So do you have somebody that can serve in the role that of a wealth advisor says, I can look at the entire balance sheet and think through the exercise of whether it's through, again, an exit from an entity, real estate transaction, whatever it might be, what's this balance sheet look like today? What's the aspirational goals that you have? And what's the universe that you can pick from? There's a big difference between someone that can sit in that seat and kind of guide someone through that process, not just once, but on a recurring basis, especially in a fiduciary position, that's even more important, versus someone that maybe sits in a box that has the ability to advise on certain pieces of balance sheet allocation, public market securities, maybe life insurance, something like that. There's different roles, and they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. You might find an advisory practice that says, we don't do any guidance on life insurance. And so they might engage a financial advisory team that focuses 100% on insurance practice to solve the needs for the client from that perspective.
So the wealth advisor, to make sure I'm going to restate this so that I'm sure I'm clear. Mm-hmm. So the wealth advisor, they're taking an overall picture of your entire, all your desires associated with your, with what you want to do with your money,
right,
and helping to quarterback that or assist you to quarterback that effort. And you might bring in all kinds of experts to help do that,
right?
Life insurance, maybe even real estate, who
sure.
knows?
Yep.
But just people to bring the whole thing together. And you mentioned, and then a financial advisor is more like a stockbroker by and large, if you sure. will. They're the ones that I've talked to over the years as an old guy, they're typically want to keep you in stocks and bonds. And, you know, there's kind of this area where, you know, we get paid when, you know, you have your money in these
right.
type of investments. So
sure.
that's what we prefer you keep in, keep
right.
your stuff in. But then you use the term fiduciary.
Yeah.
So when does somebody become a fiduciary?
Yes. So there's, that's a great question. So depending upon an advisor, as an example, our firm, how they serve a client and how they roll up. So we're an independent registered investment advisor. So we're a legal fiduciary for clients. And so there's really two rules that apply, best interest rule or fiduciary. And so the best interest rule, and I'm not saying necessarily that the best interest rule is not as good as a fiduciary. I say we serve in a fiduciary capacity. We think it's the most appropriate way for us to serve. There's different legal requirements that are applied given your position. So if I'm sitting at maybe a large Wall Street firm, I might serve in that best interest capacity. If I'm sitting as an independent advisor, for the most part, you'll see them serving in fiduciary capacities. That's something that we take very seriously. We designate that in every document for our engagements to say this is how we're serving. And why that's important is not just the minute we say we recommend you do this, but along the way, thinking through the exercise of these are the things based upon our conversations we're having that are good for you today, tomorrow, and in the future as we continue to work together. So,
yeah, when I think of the word fiduciary, I think that you have my best interests in mind and you're advising me that way. What was the other one again? That's not
the best interest.
It is called best interest. Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it is somewhat nuanced, but
yeah.
Now, how would you classify the people that basically stocks and bonds salespeople?
Yeah.
Are they best interest people?
Yeah. Again, it really depends on how their firm designates. And I do want to be very clear. There are some incredibly gifted, qualified people on both sides of the spectrum. So I think for an individual, it's finding what's the right fit for them. But yeah, from the perspective of best interest rule versus fiduciary rule, it's really how does their firm take that position and designate from there. So,
okay. And interesting. So that, do you guys get paid differently? Is a fiduciary have a different fee structure?
Yeah, so fiduciaries typically can only earn the fees that they charge. So if we charge, as an example, with a lot of our clients that go through exits, we'll charge a flat dollar fee. So whether it's guiding on the upfront and just helping with the transition and then moving on, or if it's on a recurring basis, a lot of times we'll charge just a flat dollar. And say it's going to cost X amount per year for us to do the work that we're going to do for you, regardless if you have money in public market securities, all indirect investments, whatever it might be. paying for advice. And again, for us, it's fiduciary advice.
So, okay. So then if somebody puts their money with you and it's a lot in stocks, let's say, mm-hmm. you're that amount that they have invested with you in stocks, it's not part of your, you don't take a small percentage of that?
There are some times that we will.
Okay.
We typically have, if we're running directly impacting portfolio strategy, we'll put a percentage fee as most okay. firms would. Depending upon the size, the capital position of a client, we might not do that at all and just have a flat dollar fee. So we have flexibility, I guess is the best way to explain that, to where depending upon what's the most positive way to impact the client experience, what's the right fit for them. Obviously, we've got to make sure that we can make enough revenue to stay in business and earn a profit and things like that. But we have flexibility to design our fee structure that says, if it's better for us to bill this way and focus on portfolio management, that we can do that. If we can engage in a flat fee for just planning, we can do that. If there's an engagement that has a flat fee schedule because the capital position's large and we advise on everything, we can do that too.
Okay.
So we have a lot of flexibility from that perspective.
And you and I have talked before about the onboarding process. Mm-hmm. And so I've imagined this, you meet the advisors, you get introduced to the advisors, sure. and you basically lay out as part of the onboarding, that's when you start talking about what you want out of life.
Yeah.
And then the planning process begins. Is that like, it's not an hour. That's got to be like multiple days, or how does that work?
Yeah. Sometimes clients don't necessarily want to see us that much when we go through this process, but it's very in depth, because when you go through the exercise of, you know, I'm planning for not just the rest of my life, but my generationally down or organizations that I care about, that's a very in-depth conversation. And so we're typically going through it compartmentally. So we'll go through the exercise of structure and design. You know, what are you trying to accomplish? How do we logistically set things up to make your life efficient? And then qualitatively, let's sit down and talk about it. And so for us, that's usually 2 to 3, sometimes 4-hour discussions. And we dig in really deep about what's important to them, especially for those clients that we do multi-generational planning for, and thinking through, okay, my kids are 7 and 10, or my kids are 23 and 27. How do I make sure that, one, this new wealth creation event that we've gone through doesn't take away from their own drive and willingness to be an engaged member of society and work hard? But then, two, how do we teach them to be good stewards? Even not to get
how do you teach the children to build the growth of the money, the assets?
Yeah, it's super important. We've seen it. There's a saying, shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in 3 generations. And so we take that very seriously, because we've unfortunately seen it go the wrong way. And so we try and get engaged as early as possible with lots of different platforms and programs for clients that we engage in that with. So where the kids don't necessarily know the decimal place on the balance sheet, but they clearly know that if there's multiple houses in the family or they go travel certain ways, there's wealth. How do you educate them and bring them into the value system, make them be part of that is super important. That's where you see like a foundation is a great educational tool, or a family LLC as an investment strategy, a great educational tool for the next generation or Generation 3, because you can bring them in and let's talk about what we're doing and how does this make sense and what are we trying to accomplish with it? It's a really effective strategy.
Interesting to think about how divisive it can be with family members, because it's like you've got this family business, or it may even be an actual family business getting handed down from one generation to the next. And how do we not kill each other as we try to navigate this? Because there's personalities. And,
sure.
you know, the older sibling might be more dominant, or you might have somebody with a different level of experience in finances and that is more qualified. And
right.
So just getting those people to understand how delicate that is.
Right. Yeah. I think, you know, the term seat at the table is super important. If you can have everyone be open and engaging and sitting at the table together, whether again, it's an acquisition to where everyone is now gone and now it's just a member of the family dynamic of how do we manage wealth as a family? Or if there's just a transition generationally of the business down, making sure that those are still engaged. We've seen it to where, you know, one stays in the business and one is out of the business. And then sometimes that can be a negative interaction. So making sure that we create this ecosystem of discussion and dialogue, super important.
Okay. So last question here on your questions, implications of the total return.
Yeah. Yeah. So we think through the idea of total return, especially when we think about the tax implications of total return. You know, there's two ways to grow a piece, grow an asset. It's either cash flow that you receive by giving it to somebody else to invest in something, real estate, public markets, whatever it might be. And then it's the growth, the appreciation of value. And so as you think through the idea of, again, the example of somebody exiting through a transaction, and they've now got this these separate buckets or silos they've invested in, how does silo number one create growth versus silo two? What are the tax implications of that? How do I receive it? How do I make sure it continues to grow? So thinking through the exercise of, like your comment earlier about mobile home parks, if I invest in that, I'm going to get some extra tax benefit that I can maybe use to offset a direct investment in a logistics warehouse or this piece of residential property that I own. So really going through that exercise, and again, going back to, I keep harping on this, but that cohesive team, making sure that one, tax is on board with strategy overall, thinking through the exercise of how, where am I going to have tax exposure from income or growth? And then two, assets are owned properly. So either in trust structures, in corporate structures like LLCs, where I have protections and things like that. So as you get into the idea of a much more complicated balance sheet allocation, you want to make sure all of those things are considered.
Okay, let's check out ChatGPT.
All right.
Okay, I'll zip through these kind of quick here. So why do I want to sell? Reflect on your motivations and goals. Are you seeking a new challenge, want to capitalize on your success? Experiencing personal or financial reasons that make selling appealing.
Yeah.
Is that different than what you said?
It's a little different.
That was number one. Is it the right time to sell? We talked about that a little bit.
Yeah.
What's the company's valuation? Mm-hmm. Well, that's a big thing because people want to know what the valuation of their company is.
Right.
And obviously a construction company has a different sort of multiple, different valuation based upon its dynamics than maybe a tech company with the same revenue.
Totally.
So how that plays out is huge. When someone comes to you and says, what's my company worth?
Right.
Do you send them to somebody, a CPA to evaluate that or a specific advisor?
Yeah, it really all depends what they're trying to accomplish. So if the goal is like, hey, I'm just curious, there's relatively simple ways to figure that out through technology. If the goal is to really think through it, I might consider selling in the next 2 or 3 years, then there's two ways to go about it. One, you can hire a valuation company. They do a formal evaluation, go through a quality of earnings study, all these different things, and apply the appropriate multiples. Or you get engaged with iBanks, investment banks, and you say, hey, this is an individual that owns a technology company in this space. I know you guys focus in that area. Let's have a discussion. Yeah. And so there's ways to explore it without necessarily making it a very, super deep and complicated process. But it really is important to have an understanding, because you might say, I really want to sell in the next 2 years, and you go through that exercise. Well, given the economic environment, the value that you come back with through the exercise, you might say, either I'm selling tomorrow or I'm going to put it off for 5 years.
Yeah.
So.
And in investment banks too, if some of them that are really focused on your market and certain types of markets, they really are in touch with reality and what you can get for your asset
that.
Because, I mean, that's huge. And they're going to use comps and maybe the current market, appetite for what you got going.
Yep.
Okay. What is the company's valuation? Went through that one. How is the company positioned? Evaluate the company's market position, brand reputation, customer base, and competitive advantage.
Yeah. So that's a really in-depth part of the process when you go through the exercise of, preparing for an exit. Because again, if my brand recognition is relatively poor, given my customer segment or geography, then you've got to work on that. And that's going to take some time to build that up. If it's positioned well, but overlaps too much with maybe some strategic buyers, it might limit the ability for you to be able to transact the way that you want. So that's definitely part of a really good, thorough process.
Are there potential buyers? I mean, that's pretty huge. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who would buy it? Nobody wants to buy it.
Right. Yeah. That's helpful.
Yeah. That's kind of obvious, I suppose. But, I think people, this is my opinion also, is that us entrepreneurs think our company is worth more than it really is most of the time.
Yeah.
We always have this little inflated, because we heard about somebody else who did something. Ours is as good as theirs. And you think that it's, but it seems like it's usually wrong.
Well, it all depends. But there are times where you might be in a segment of the market to where there aren't a lot of potential buyers. So understanding that is super important. Or if the economy or the economic environment doesn't necessarily support that business model right now, whether it's the segment that you support from a client perspective, customer perspective, or just the scale that you're in, maybe you're in a smaller market, smaller size business, there's just no appetite to acquire something like that. Those things ebb and flow like the economic cycles do. So making sure that you don't have to sell is very important.
What's interesting to think, and we talked at the beginning about that unsolicited offer, and at that stage, do you go hire an investment banker to run a process so that you get multiple buyers involved to drive up the price? I guess it all depends on how certain you are to close and if it's enough money for you. But typically the investment banker is the one that can get multiple buyers to the table.
Absolutely. And that's, you talked about it before, when you've got, especially somebody that's maybe market focused, if they know the geography that you're in or the segment of business that you're in, they're going to probably know a lot of the strategic players. And again, we're thinking about an outside acquisition, not an internal sale. But going through that exercise, it's very simple for someone to say, okay, now that I know your company, in detail, exactly who you serve, exactly where you sit, where you can exit, where the owner goes, they can probably find a very simple connection to multiple potential buyers, strategic buyers, that make a lot of sense. So investment banks can be very, very valuable in the process.
Yeah. ChatGPT, I think the next question is pretty obvious. What are the tax implications? We talked about that quite a bit. Yeah. That's a given. How will the sale affect stakeholders? We've talked about that. Mm-hmm. What are the terms of the deal? That's interesting. I don't know that we got into that much, because a lot of times somebody will come in and want to acquire us, and the terms, might not be attractive, but the price is.
Right. Yeah, and that's an important exercise as you think through it, because you might find that exact thing. Maybe they're requiring an earnout, so I've got to stay on for 5 years. You explained your experience.
Yeah.
That doesn't always work out. You might be the owner and the person that's built it up and been running it, and you now fall under a different umbrella, and maybe you want to play under that umbrella the way that they want you to. So the terms are super important, and that's where, again, I go back to leaning on advisory teams. In that particular example, attorneys that are focused on document structure and design for a transaction are very, very incredibly valuable. So
I got a buddy who we both know that sold his company, and he got a lot of equity and almost no cash. So he's rolling equity in the combined entity, in the new entity, which, may or may not be a good idea, but that term is a lot different than cash.
It does. Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
And the tax treatment is different too. So when you think about it, depending upon the size of the companies, you might be able to swap equity from your company to another company with no upfront tax liability. So there's benefits there, but there's risks. Mm-hmm. The idea of, now I just have equity in something and it has to perform, and if it doesn't, that could be a problem.
Yeah, and when we sell a company, like my story, many times you think you're in a position to drive the vision and maybe shape the vision.
Sure.
And it really turns out that you're a minority owner now, and you don't keep your mouth shut, boy.
Yeah, just stay over there.
Yeah, here's your job. Oh, I thought I was the president.
Yeah, yeah. It can change. The dynamic can change dramatically, for sure.
Let's see. What are the terms of the deal? What is the post-sale plan? Yeah, that's, we spent a lot of time talking about that. Mm-hmm. Should I seek professional advice? That's obvious. We talked about that. It's very, very important. Mm-hmm. In fact, get somebody that has the right team in place.
Yep.
And then, that was the last question. Looks like ChatGPT, not bad. Is artificial intelligence bad?
I feel like we're in good shape.
It's a helpful tool.
Yeah. I totally agree with that.
All right. So, closing thoughts to those people that might be listening that are aspiring to build a company that's got a lot of value, or maybe they even have a company that's a lot of value. Mm-hmm. Maybe just some overarching closing thoughts for those people.
Yeah, no, I just want to say thanks again for having me out today. I think the idea, the exercise of due diligence and thought around planning is very, very important. And what I mean by that is thinking through the idea of, at some point, you're not going to show up like you do every single day, and planning through the exercise of, What's important for my family? What's important to the employees that support and drive the business like a lot of them do? But proactively thinking through the exercise of, hey, at some point I can maybe monetize the equity position. Again, we think a lot about businesses being lifestyle supporting, so paying the bills and keeping me going. But thinking through the exercise of, if I exit, what's the capital position look like moving forward? What are the most efficient and proper ways to go through that? Our biggest advice is think through that earlier, if at all possible. Engage in teams that can support that and think about what's the best thing for you as an individual and a family as you go through something like that.
Don't get ready when the opportunity is there. Be ready when the opportunity is there and you can seize that opportunity.
Totally agree.
Thanks for coming on the show, Jay.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Mark.
You bet.
Now, let's get Mark's perspective and closing thoughts from today's show. We're back to the Marquee Media Studio. It's the Mark Haney Show.
Welcome back to the Mark Haney Show. Jay Ezell, part of the Backyard Advantage, a major part of the Backyard Advantage. As our entrepreneurs in town win, they need to have a plan for what to do as they win. And Jay really is the guy in Sacramento that if you're going to sell your company or have an exit or something great happen, you want to make sure you preserve that wealth. And Jay's the guy that can make sure that you've got the plan to be most efficient. So, Jay, thank you for coming on the show. And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the Backyard Advantage, and, of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at Haney Biz, at Mark Haney Show, and the Growth Factory, we're never above you, we're never below you, always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in this segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.